Hello, welcome everyone to Encrypt Today to Safeguard Tomorrow. We're kicking off with the first session of the day, Courts at the Crossroads, Defending Digital Rights Against Encryption Crackdowns in South Asia. Let me just pass it to Karthika just so she can start the session today. Thank you.
Thank you, Raquel. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Global Encryption Day Summit 2024. I'm Karthika Rajmohan. I'm an Associate Policy Counsel with the Internet Freedom Foundation. We are a New Delhi-based civil liberties organization working on digital rights issues, and I'll be moderating the session today. IFF is thrilled to be organizing a panel as part of the GED Summit. The discussion today, like Raquel mentioned, would be on Courts at Crossroads, Defending Digital Rights Against Encryption Crackdowns in South Asia. The inspiration behind this panel and the context that we're sort of relying on is the increasing amount of governmental efforts to curtail end-to-end encryption under the guise of national security and crime prevention. We're very glad we have a panel of extremely qualified, esteemed speakers who are digital rights experts from various South Asian countries. I'll briefly introduce all of the speakers. Firstly, we have Dr. Sanjana Hatotua. He is a disinformation expert at ICT for Peace Foundation, wherein he studies information disorders and its impact on democracy and society. Next, we have Ms. Vrinda Bhandari. She's an independent advocate who litigates free speech and digital rights issues in India. And she's also an off-counsel with Internet Freedom Foundation. Next, we have Mr. Shahzad Mahmood. He's a senior researcher at the Tech Global Institute, where his work primarily examines online content regulations, AI, and deepfakes. Then we have Ms. Fariha Aziz. She's a co-founder of Holobee, a civil society organization geared towards advocacy, policy, and research in areas of digital rights and civic responsibility. And lastly, we have Mr. Santosh Sigdal, the executive director of Digital Rights Nepal, a non-profit initiative directed to protection and promotion of digital rights in Nepal. So now that we have introduced our panelists, we could perhaps move on to some opening statements. Maybe the panelists could start by giving us some context on what is the situation in their respective countries, what are the kinds of crackdowns that governments have been doing against end-to-end encryption and the kind of justifications that are being used the same. I think for opening statements, perhaps we could start with Dr. Sanjana, if you would like to begin.
Thanks, and glad to be here. I'll keep it short. For those from the region, Sri Lanka is a known story. We've just had a consequential presidential election, so we don't know whether what we have seen in the past will continue into the future. One hopes not. But the general context of the country has been a familiar story for other South Asian countries as well, where state authority, executive authority, and impunity have impeded the freedom of expression and fundamental rights in the country for decades, well before social media. But it has been exacerbated as a consequence of increasing interest in private privileged communications by the state and the securitized state in particular, in the guise as was introduced to curtail and combat terrorism, but also in Sri Lanka, with a view to protection of women and children argument, where there has been a lot of regulation and laws passed or contemplated to be passed to ostensibly protect women and children, but is quite damning with regards to first principles. I just speak to two. One is an absolutely draconian law, unprecedented in the country's legislative history, called the Online Safety Act, which came into play in January this year. It's a longer story as to how it came about, but now it's in our statute books, and I can't use, because of the code of conduct, expletives on this call, but it is horrible. It is antithetical to every imaginable human rights in the Constitution. It's extraterritorial. It applies to everybody, on Earth, as incredible as that may sound, it goes back in time to the first time that you would have used the internet. And it's incredibly privacy encroaching. It is under the executive, which is a big problem because of the constitutional nature of the country and how powerful the executive is. It allows the law to get into any device, anywhere, at any time, over anything, over a category of content called prohibited content. And that's not me making it up. That's in the law. That may mean anything. So it's not well defined. In fact, there are clauses in the law that I've said read like a romance novel, because in the law, it's said that if you say something that upsets the feelings of a community, that's a possible intervention point. And I've said that I have no feelings when I've written love letters or whether I've received love letters, but it's very strange to find that language in law. So the OSA can force disclosure, and it's actually really quite bad. It impacts E2EE obliquely in a context where, you must understand, in Sri Lanka at least, where we are a very violent country. And the Ministry of Defense regularly and over decades has, without any kind of due process, twisted the arm of telcos to get the information that they want. So just to make it very clear, you don't need in Sri Lanka to undermine E2EE when you can actually arm twist the telcos to get metadata or some of the data that you might want around targeted individuals or institutions, which are generally human rights activists. I'll end by saying that there is a second law which is in the draft stage, and we don't know whether it's going to go ahead with the new executive president and the government, the parliamentary elections in a couple of weeks. We don't know what the timeline of it is, but under the former government, it was going to be introduced quite soon, which is called the Anti-Terrorism Act. So we have a Prevention of Terrorism Act, which is draconian, but now we have an Anti-Terrorism Act, which is ostensibly trying to fix the PTA, but it's actually quite worse. And here we take a branch, a page of India, where, you know, the Indians on this call can speak to the High Court, Delhi High Court case with Facebook and Meta and WhatsApp, and, you know, the whole conundrum about them moving out of the biggest market if they were compelled to undermine their own E2E with WhatsApp. But Section 65 of the proposed draft of Sri Lanka's ATA is the exact same thing. It will compel all internet intermediaries and anybody, really, to give up their keys, give up their information. So it goes to the intermediary level, it goes to the platform level, but it also goes to the individual level. I won't read out the clause, but there's nothing like it again in our statute books. And my point has been, if WhatsApp and Meta wanted to get out of India on account of what they were possibly being compelled to do, we as a country are less than the market of Mumbai. So I've kind of alerted folks that, what do you think Meta is going to do in Sri Lanka if this law comes about? So I'll end by saying that it's not the case that we are as bad as India or Bangladesh or Pakistan or some of the other countries, but the proclivity, the political preference and the bias is to undermine encrypted privileged communications. And this is now something of a bit of a central focus of those in the MOD and those in government, with a view to kind of getting into civil society activism and getting into privileged communications that they think is inconvenient, because it's inconvenient for them. So the argument is made around ostensibly curtailing terrorism, protecting women and children. But we all know, I hope, on this call and in the audience, that the end result of that is absolutely detrimental to first principles. So that's the general broad context of Sri Lanka as it stands today.
Thank you for that. That was very useful. Lawyer points I would love to double click on, but we'll come to that later. Now, if Vinda Bhandari, ma'am, if you could start your opening statement.
Hi. I think it's perfect to go next in terms of, you know, we've already seen the context of Sri Lanka. So I think India sort of follows suit. And I'll start maybe by actually talking about the challenge that has been issued by WhatsApp. So what happened was in 2021, the government amended, basically introduced rules called the intermediary. I mean, they have a very long name, but for our purpose, I'm going to call them the IT rules of 2021. Now, interestingly, this was not done through legislation. It was done through the government issuing a notification. So under the rulemaking power of the government. And what happens there is you avoid parliamentary scrutiny, you avoid legislative debate. So it's easier to pass things through. So it was in the exercise of its rulemaking powers that the government introduced these IT rules, which were in two parts. The first part sort of dealt with intermediaries and codified and added additional new due diligence obligations. And the second part dealt with, news publishers online, so digital news publishers and online content providers. So the controversial portion was Rule 4, Subclause 2 of these IT rules, which effectively requires these significant social media intermediaries, which is every intermediary, WhatsApp was easily included. So if you have more than 50 lakh users, you would be classified as a significant social media intermediary. And what this did, so there were two parts that came in the rule. First, I'll talk about the part that in a way has been challenged, but has been completely complied with. So this goes to your question, Kartika, where we're saying, what is the government's argument? So the government's argument to some extent was all these social media platforms, none of them have offices in India, right? All their offices are in the US or in Europe. So every time we have any law enforcement request, it's very difficult to get the data for us. Because, they'll say, oh, we don't have the data is not stored in India, the data is subject to US law. So what these rules did, they mandated everybody, which is a significant social media intermediary, to have a resident grievance officer who was based in India. And what that does is when any company has to have an officer who, has to be based in India and then is subject to the jurisdiction of Indian laws very directly and Indian court, it encourages compliance. So that was the government's argument. They said, we need to have better compliance. We need to have data, access to data which are used in crimes. And hence, we need all these companies to have a separate grievance request. So if you actually go to, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, all of these pages, they have Twitter, they all have a separate grievance redressal officer who's designated for the purpose of Indian law. So that the government did because they said it's very difficult for us to get data under the MLAT process, which is a mutual legal assistance treaty process. So that was the first part. The more controversial part, and sort of what we've touched upon a bit, is that Rule 4.2 effectively requires these companies that for providing messaging services to disclose the sender of the message on any order, right? Now, this disclosure has to be done for cases of national security, public order, any offenses, child sexual abuse material, etc. And the main challenge that WhatsApp did is that they said, look, this is going to break encryption. We cannot disclose the originator of the message unless we know who's the originator of the message. And what I also want to point out is that it is actually very rare for tech platforms in India, and I'd kind of be interested to hear other countries' experiences, but it is fairly rare for tech platforms in India to take a proactive challenge to the law. Usually their respondents are, they're impleaded as respondents against, some other petitioner challenging or the government order, but it is very rare for a social media platform to actually actively challenge the law. And so this was an interesting example because it was one of the first cases. Twitter then followed up later with a blocking challenge. But this was interesting because it's the first time WhatsApp said, look, we cannot identify the originator of information. Doing that will break end-to-end encryption. That is not how we work. Once we create a backdoor for one person, we have to create a backdoor for everybody. So the rule actually was very clear. The government was trying to say, look, we've made lots of safeguards, so you don't have to break encryption if any other less intrusive means are possible. The rules also provide, according to the government, they say that if you have to comply with the identification of the first originator, you are not required to disclose the contents of any message, or any other information related to the first information originator related to its users. And then the rules also provide that when the first originator of the information is located outside India, the government of India is only interested in the first originator within India. So you see, it's not just that you're breaking encryption. You also then have to break it geographically. So you have to see who is the originator, who is first in India. So I think this is it in terms of background for this Rule 42 challenge. What I will say is, although this came in 2021, finally, 3 years later, the government, the court, the Delhi High Court now is hearing petitions challenging these rules. And they finally set it down for hearing. And so we are hoping that maybe in November, December or early next year, actually hearings in this will conclude. So we're actually, after many years on this point, we are actually going to be able to see some hearings. So we are in court on that. And then just very quickly, I just want to also mention, apart from these rules, there were also these cert in rules. So this is the security centralization, you know, the centralized security agency rules. And that deals with VPN providers. And I just wanted to touch on that because that basically said that all VPN providers have to mandatorily enable logs of all information systems, you know, all their users, the names, address, contact details, email addresses, etc., which was also challenged by a separate VPN provider, IFF Provider Systems, in both these petitions. And so that's another thing that if people are interested, we can talk about more because that, you know, deals with encryption in a different sort of way or deals with privacy in a different sort of scenario. So I think that's all for right now for India.
Thank you. That was super useful. A lot of interesting context. And this is something that I think has sort of set jurisprudence across multiple other jurisdictions as well. So now if we could hear from Mr. Shahzad Mahmood, would you like to start with your opening statement?
Thank you, Partika. So I'd like to start by addressing some of the issues raised by my previous panelists speaking on the matter. So Dr. Sandhana Patat, who I think he highlighted quite correctly that the legacy of the colonial laws, the languages that are used in this field, some of the colonial laws that we share, that permeated into the current legal landscape governing the internet, which very much characterized how policies are developed in South Asia. Ms. Rinda Mandrari also mentioned that tech companies proactively pursuing cases is an exception. And my research has also shown, and I concur, that it is an exception. And these are based predominantly on the internal policies of the companies. Happy to talk about it more. But as far as Bangladesh is concerned, the courts have had limited engagement with privacy jurisprudence. There was this one case from a few years ago where the High Court Division recognized that routine collection of call details and audio records without due process, without following due process, and their unauthorized disclosure as leaked audios, it constituted breach of fundamental rights guaranteed under Article 43 of the Constitution. Yet, robust judicial intervention against fake and co-sharing in the areas of encryption, surveillance, and digital privacy remains quite minimal. So I'd like to point out three issues that characterize this lack of intervention. The first is fake surveillance and interception, which are routinely carried out by covertly under by the recently ousted regime. And it was often done in collaboration with the telecom operator, including a lot of multinational subsidiaries. This was enabled by broad provisions in the Bangladesh Telecommunication Regulation Act and the telecom licensing regime, and justified by an expensive interpretation of Article 43's exception, which permits restrictions on privacy on national security and public order grounds. And these terms problematically remain inadequately defined in Bangladesh. I know that it's fairly well defined in India, but in Bangladesh, it's still relatively undefined. The Supreme Court of Bangladesh have the mandate to assess constitutionality of laws and administrative actions. And over the years, historically, they have been quite proactive in legal reforms through Suamotu rulings, through exercising extraordinary jurisdiction, issuing guidelines, passing seminal decisions. But the relative inertness of the judiciary against systemic state surveillance over the last one decade is something I believe that has not gone unnoticed. The second issue I would like to touch upon is the issue of encryption, which is a simmering issue in Bangladesh and an excellent case study for regional contagion. India's enacted the information technology rules in 2020-2021, introducing the traceability provision. which is essentially a requirement to identify the first originator of message shared on certain message and other intermediary services. Now, Ms. Vrinda Bhandari has covered it quite well, so I'm not going to get into the details of it. But it's quite interesting how this came about in Bangladesh. It came through a constitutional challenge by Chigay of repetition and involving content regulation. And traceability requirement was introduced in the first draft of the proposed regulation submitted to the High Court by the Bangladesh Telecommunication Regulatory Commission. Unlike India, however, there are no threshold requirements, and the provision was meant to have extraterritorial reach. So technically, all service providers and even non-residents were caught under the regulation. Now, we, along with Internet Society and Access Now, raise awareness on how this would harm journalists, rights advocates, and opposition, because at the time there was limited to no understanding and awareness of how these provisions operated. And we did a lot of myth-busting around this in how this is an ineffective solution to a genuine problem. Now, there are two arguments at the time that I heard from the proponents of traceability provisions. The first argument is that traceability is essential in a country like Bangladesh to identify perpetrators of communal violence. And within the constitutional architecture, it is both reasonable and warranted under national security and public order grounds with the counterbalance against privacy consideration. And given that intermediaries in most cases anyway comply only when they want to, so naturally pushback against overreaching request is expected. So that was the first argument. The second argument, and an argument that I found more interesting, is that traceability is being reframed as a privacy violating provision when in fact it is thought was the argument. Intermediaries do not necessarily have to break into an encryption, and that they can easily develop rights-respecting technological backdoors to assist state authorities to address on-the-ground real-world problem that is being faced in Bangladesh. So the argument was that you do not necessarily have to break end-to-end encryption in order to enforce the traceability provision to get to the first originator of the message. There are other ways of doing it, just like how Google, for example, developed content ID to get copyright content. You just have to invest in technology to get to a point where you can do it without breaking into an encryption. Now, ultimately what happened was because there was no policy or technological solution forthcoming from the proponents of traceability provision, it was eventually dropped from the revised draft of the regulation that was submitted to the court. Again, however, in the silence of the court in addressing the issue head-on has not gone unnoticed. And finally, and very quickly, the third issue is how over the years many services that enable end-to-end encryption have been restricted in Bangladesh, especially in the last decade and a half. Again, judicial intervention has been lacking here as well. I've documented these restrictions in an internet shutdown report published by Internews and Optima, as well as article published in National Dailies. In the interest of time, with that, I would like to thank the moderators for the time and happy to take any question.
Thank you so much. Again, interesting points raised that we would love to get back to. But next, if we could have Ms. Pariha Aziz to give her opening statement.
Thanks, Karthika. So many similarities and parallels that I'm hearing from previous speakers. Let me try and walk you through just this year in Pakistan with respect to what has been in place. So this was election year, very controversial elections, and the question of legitimacy and mandate still continues. And our courts are literally at the crossroads right now. Just early this morning, which is at 4 a.m. passage of a constitutional amendment, steamrolled through both houses of parliament without any debate. The judicial appointment process has been amended, and this is a controversial amendment again, where the handpicking of a chief justice is going to happen. The commission who is going to appoint judges is now tilted heavily in favor of the current political setup. So we're going to see how all of this pans out. And now constitutional benches have been formed within the Supreme Court and the High Court, and how that bifurcation is going to happen, we're going to see, because litigation was one avenue, even though sometimes you don't get very far. But still, courts were a venue for and a site for contesting some of the violations that occur. And all of that now is sort of up in the air, and we'll see how all of this settles. But February, we had the elections, internet disruptions were happening, and then we see that X is blocked. First, there's no official acknowledgement from the government, and then it so transpired that there was a notification, and the information minister said, and then finally there were basically cases before various high courts of the country. At the moment, all high courts of the country, there are petitions pending regarding the ban on X. And what they ultimately submitted in court was that X has been banned on account of national security. And so obviously relating it to, well, firstly, election-related disinformation. But then also it became about, you know, terrorism, as Dr. Sanjana also said. So, for example, you know, there is, and not just, you know, terrorism in the context of what is the government refers to as separatist movements in the different provinces, where the military chief has also come on television to coin the phrase digital terrorism in relation to political parties and their workers using social media. So there's that aspect of it as well. And then the second thing that the government said in its submission to court, and this is something that Ms. Rinda also spoke about, rules. So we have the social media rules under the Prevention of Electronic Crimes Act, which is enacted in 2016, the first cybercrime law. And in it, what was done was, and we have, I'm sure, shared frameworks, Article 19, freedom of expression from our constitution, was literally copy-pasted into this piece of criminal legislation. And the Telecommunications Authority was given, in my view, our judicial and legislative powers to essentially interpret and apply the exceptions that exist. And we have a long list of exceptions in Article 19, where you have the right to freedom of expression, but subject to glory of ISAV and national security and friendly relations, and the list goes on and on for the exceptions. And so we've seen arbitrarily how the Telecommunications Authority has blocked different websites and platforms from time to time, and then came the social media rules. And again, borrowing from India and other jurisdictions, and the intent always was, we want these companies to form offices and appoint staff. And so, and again, the grouse with the with X particularly is that they don't comply with our requests, and they haven't opened offices as per our requirement. And in Pakistan, none of these companies have a presence, unlike other in the region. So that's the difference. And again, the same argument that, you know, we send them requests and they don't comply with these requests. And so it becomes this carrot and stick tactic where they'll keep them blocked till they come to the table and start complying to some degree. And this has happened with other platforms in the past. So that happens. And then we also hear that, I mean, internet has been excessively slow. We hear that it's submarine cable faults, but also that there's a so-called national firewall being installed and interchangeably being used with a web monitoring system or a management system. And previously, there had been procurement from Sandvine, Deep Packet Inspection Technology. So then that part as well added on. And, you know, what was mentioned, I think, in the Indian context as well, is that those who are locally incorporated, so the telcos and the ISPs, and there's very little they feel they can do because their licenses can be cancelled at any time. And so for them, it's sort of like the path of least resistance, and they go on and comply. One very significant court case recently was about this surveillance system, the Lawful Intercept Management System, as it was called. And it's been in place since 2013, but it wasn't until in a political case where audios had been leaked of the former First Lady and also the son of a former Chief Justice. They went to court, you know, and the hearings and orders ensued. Turns out 4 million subscribers at a time, their data is being passed through a centralized system, just being handed over. And there's no scrutiny. And when the court inquired under what authority are you doing this, turns out that nobody, no agency was authorized. And so what happens is post facto, an executive notification is issued authorizing the Inter-Services Agency, which is the ISI, to conduct this surveillance. Now, that was challenged as well. But what ended up happening is that the High Court order got challenged before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court essentially stayed and restored the surveillance regime, which was stayed previously by the High Court. So here we're also seeing how different courts, different judges are responding to things. The ex-ban petitions have been pending for months now, and High Court orders are being violated as well. We're also against the backdrop of this, the so-called firewall. You know, they're being able to disrupt certain functionalities. The signal was blocked. WhatsApp media dysfunction. So on mobile data, we're not able to transmit WhatsApp media unless there's a VPN on. So what has enhanced capability do they have to be able to do this? VPN registration and blocking, on the other hand, is going on. Wide listing of IPs, which the businesses are asked to go through, and they are complying with because they've also faced issues. So that also is ongoing at the moment. And of course, we have regulation. So in terms of, even if it's not content data that they may have access to, metadata, as was mentioned, right? And it's willingly handed over. And then you have centralized systems where they're able to get all of that. So they want to know where are messages originating, who is communicating with whom, even if it's not the data. And on the other hand, in terms of getting to the data, we've had widespread raids, arrests, illegal detentions, search and seizures, despite the fact that the law requires a warrant. A warrant is not sought. People are then forced to provide passwords or access to their phones, and that's how the information is accessed and the content is accessed. So chats, who you're communicating with, drawing those links, building those cases. Sometimes even anti-terrorism laws are used in combination with the cybercrime laws. And then all of this to get admitted into evidence in the trials. And usually these trials are not necessarily always to get to a conviction, but as I keep saying, it's process as punishment. Once you've been able to obtain access and coerce and do what you need to, then that's essentially the objective is achieved. So this is essentially where we are at right now, where all of this is still, it continues to play out. And now we feel that even the courts, we don't know what this new structure under the amendment is going to hold for us.
Thank you for that, Faya. A lot of very interesting points that I'd love to take forward. Lastly, if we could have Santosh Sikkal to please give his opening statement.
Thanks, Kartika. After listening to Dr. Sanjay, Brinda, Saza, and Fariza, I can conclude that we have the similar trend across South Asia regarding regulating digital space or digital rights. The tactics of the government is similar also. In Nepal, there are twofold of regulation. One is through the executive orders and executive actions, and another is through the laws and policies. So since last few years, the government has started proposing a number of policies that they want to regulate the digital space. And in a bigger picture, it was also because of the, in the last election, there were new political parties and young independent candidates. They took over the old guards, and in many of the, including the capital city, a metropolitan city of capital, there was a young guy who was able to got elected as a mayor. He was a rapper. So these people thought that it was all due to the social media. We cannot get hold of, we cannot be in the race if we cannot control social media. There was a kind of a sentiment among the old parties, old guards. And in the executive front, there has been a number of instances where the government is trying to surveil the communication, at the same time keeping tab on the people. They have proposed this Media Device Management Service, MDMS, through the telcos, and at the same time there is telecommunication, traffic monitoring, and fraud control mechanism of Teramox. And there was also procurement, this corruption charges during the procurement processes, and There was a writ petition filed against this proposal in the court. And ultimately, the issue went to the parliamentary committee, and parliamentary committee has, they have pulled the process for now. So that has been, the Terramox has not been implemented. And last year, the government adopted national cybersecurity policy. There are a number of problematic provision in the national cybersecurity policy, including the provision of national internet gateway. So they want to establish a national internet gateway, just like that proposed in Cambodia, with where all the incoming traffic to the country has to go through the dedicated checkpoint of the government, dedicated network of the government, and all the traffic going out of the country has also through there, and they have access over all the internet traffic. So well, that is in the policy. We don't know how they are going to implement it. But after the push from the civil society and media, now they have renamed it as a kind of broadband management policy. So now the last government, they had a study which we filed. Digital Rights Nepal had filed a right to information request to get a copy of that report, but that report has not been released. So they have constituted a study on this broadband management policy where they do not want to talk it as a national internet gateway any longer, but they want to disguise it in another technical name. As you might know that they want to, that is the same argument as Brinda and others have provided, that social media companies, they are not registered in Nepal. So they adopted, last year they adopted social media guideline, which required the social media company to get registered in Nepal within 3 months. And immediately after 1 week, the TikTok was banned in last November. And more than a dozen writ applications were filed in the Supreme Court. And eventually, TikTok was also approaching the government. And the trend is similar. As said earlier, TikTok was doing the diplomacy, this negotiation through the back door rather than challenging the decision. And it was civil society organization and others who were challenging that decision. And eventually, they agreed, they negotiated. And civil society organization is still, because the details of the negotiation between the TikTok and the government is not very clear. So earlier, TikTok had said that they will provide a system to flag the content the government finds inappropriate, and they will review those contents. So now we don't know what are the other kind of, the civil society is suspicious of other possible negotiation between the TikTok, but it has been resumed in August 2024. And now the TikTok has started the process of registering in Nepal. So it is characteristic. And after that, after they blocked it for 1 year, now they are back in the country and they have started this registration process. So the government has also proposed two new bills which have very problematic provisions. One is a social media use and regulation bill, which we, Digital Rights Nepal, had analyzed, and last year we provided the input to the government, to the minister, and that is now in this legislative committee of the cabinet, and which is going to be presented in the parliament in the coming session, upcoming session. And another is information technology and cybersecurity bill. And we believe that many of the provision of the national cybersecurity policy will come through this cybersecurity bill. There are many problematic provisions regarding content takedown and providing many institutions the power to direct the social media companies to take down the content. The power has been given to at least 5 agencies. So any of the agencies, they find any content problematic, they can issue the order, and if within 24 hours content is not taken down, they will be fined with up to 10 lakhs rupees. That is around $70,000, I believe. So that is there are other many problematic provision. One major provision is intermediary accountability. So we have also analyzed that. So We are coordinating with other organizations to make some amendment, propose some amendment in this proposed bill, and we have been also working with the member of the parliament. Talking about the courts, as shared by Sajab or others, the courts has minimal role. However, there has been some cases where it has played the very important role earlier. In few years back, a sitting justice of the Supreme Court was shortened, and at that time, the investigation agencies, they have collected more than 500,000 record of the call detail and thousands of social media content text, SMS text. And at that time, we had applied to the court to challenge the decision of the investigation agencies. And at that time, the Supreme Court issued the directive orders to make laws to regulate that process, and at the same time require the judicial sanction, the approval of the district court to collect any call detail from the telcos. So that was how the court was able to kind of implement the right to privacy, a right to privacy enshrined in the constitution. And there are a number of other cases also that is currently sub judice in the Supreme Court, which may, for example, there has been a case regarding this Teramux, its implication on the right to privacy. So we are looking forward to this outcome of this sub judice cases, how the court will uphold the right to privacy. So these are some of the general scenario. Last concluding point is, the government is also trying to, because now in comparison to traditional legacy media, online media has been very robust and kind of critical. So they have come up with this online media guidelines. And now the government has proposed a media council bill, which will also kind of regulate the online media. So many of the issues that we have been discussing now, that will also impact, because social media platform of the media, mainstream media or the online media, that will also be subject to this social media bill, information technology bill. So the impact will be on the press freedom also in the coming days. Okay, that's it for now as a general context.
Thank you so much. A lot of very insightful points we received from all of our speakers. Just to sort of bring it all together, I think a sort of common thread that we've noticed across all the speakers is that there are certain, like a list of reasons that government seem to be using to justify crackdowns on end-to-end encryption. Right? They're firstly national security. Then secondly, maintaining public order, regulating hate speech and fake news. And lastly, it's facilitating sort of criminal investigation and combating child sexual abuse material, CSAM. So firstly, I'd like to direct a question to Vrinda ma'am and Dr. Sandhana, sort of just to tell us, what are courts in your country sort of doing when it comes to balancing the need to have a safe space for women and children versus the right to privacy and the freedom of expression? What are the sort of arguments that courts have been taking? What are the kind of balancing acts that debates have been surrounding? If you want to start, Vrinda ma'am.
Yeah. Apologies, Dr. Sanna. I just had to leave earlier, which is why I've asked this to be able to speak first. It's interesting that in many cases, what happens is when the court is concerned, and I think maybe this experience will be shared, I'd be interested to know that. For instance, when we talk about child rights, what often happens is it doesn't come up in a specific case, but it gets filed as what in India we call public interest litigation. So it will be filed by, say, some child rights organization saying, look, we need, you know, this is a serious problem, we need to do something. And what happens is because it gets filed as a PIL, a lot of the intermediaries don't get involved. Right. So it's the court and the PIL petitioner. And so the court then doesn't really understand what the technical aspects are, what does it mean when you say, oh, all of you must give your data to the government at all times. So while they are well intentioned, I think what we see often, and like this has happened even recently, you know, with the Supreme Court in another judgment, where they will issue guidelines to various intermediaries, which then become difficult to operationally comply with, right? But because they've never heard those concerns, that's one issue. I've also just sent a link to a paper that I had the privilege of writing with Anya Kovacs. And we actually looked at how have courts in India, when they're looking at questions of gender and sexuality, has it expanded digital rights or have they actually contracted digital rights? So I've shared this on the chat, and I think you can share it with the wider panel as well, with the wider audience as well. But what we found is many times, while well-intentioned, but to protect women, or you know, to protect the morality of women, especially when we deal with anything that's obscene, courts actually end up restricting digital rights. And we view digital rights very broadly in terms of freedom of speech and expression, privacy, all of these things. So that's one thing. When it comes to national security, unfortunately, in most cases, the government has, the court has a hands-off approach. On specific facts, it's very difficult. Like, so there was a blocking case that came about in the Delhi High Court where there was a software that, you know, they had challenged it and it had been temporarily blocked in Jammu and Kashmir. And the court said, oh, look, this is a very temporary blocking. It's for national security concerns. It's in Kashmir. And then almost it's untouchable, right? Like no court is going to go ahead and then actually challenge that. We saw that with internet shutdowns as well when they happened in Kashmir, and we had challenged that in court. And while we got a judgment, there was actually no specific implementing, like there was no judgment on the orders as such, like on the actual facts of the case. It was more a judgment on how should internet shutdowns be treated. So what we often unfortunately find is when it comes specifically to national security, it becomes very difficult for the courts to really exercise their powers of judicial review. They tend to have a more hands-off approach. And what we have tried to argue all the time is just saying something is a national security issue should not be enough. Like, there has to be some basis because otherwise it's impossible for you as a petitioner to, you know, to show or to rebut that presumption or to say why it's disproportionate. So there have been, that's, I think, where we are facing a challenge. Having said that, I would like to recommend everybody to read the recent decision of the Bombay High Court on another aspect of these IT rules. And maybe, Karthika, you could share the link to the judgment. But where the court struck down on a 2-1. So, you know, there was a first split verdict, went to a third judge, and he ruled in favor of the petitioner. IFF had also assisted in that. And where they struck down the establishment of a fact check unit, which would look at fake, false, disparaging information, vis-a-vis the government. And so this was a government notified fact check unit, and the court struck it down. So that was a really positive development. But I think by and large, this is how we dealt with it. I am really sorry I need to leave. I will just leave my contact details in case anybody wants to get in touch with me. I would love sort of to do that.
Thank you so much, Carol. A pleasure having you here. Dr. Sanjana, if you would like to add.
Yeah, so the only thing that I can add to that is that we aren't, as a country, as developed in our PIL. And our courts have been under the jackboot of the executive, just in the way that the constitutionally, the office of the executive president is constructed since 1977, which is when the current constitution was given birth. The EP is untouchable. And whoever has occupied that office has gone on to encroach on rights in every imaginable form and way. And the courts have been subject to that authority that is almost godlike. When we talk about South Asian discourse today and we talk about, for example, the fiat of Modi, we've had executive presidents like Rajapaksa since 2005 onwards completely trampling on the independence of the judiciary. So PIL has been quite effective, but it has come at significant cost. Activists have been harassed, harmed, hurt, murdered, and extrajudicially killed. And so even to kind of embark on PIL, particularly on NATSEC issues, is hugely, it's a big hurdle. So it's not easy. And we have this kind of Kafkaesque scenario, which kind of alludes to what the former speaker said, where in order to find out what the NATSEC issue is, they don't reveal what the NATSEC issue is. So it becomes a bit of a absurd scenario where you don't know what you're supposed to be fighting against, but you're told to accept it on authority, that it is an ethic issue. The other thing that I wanted to point out, and I, again, when I hear India's examples, I feel quite sad. One of the things that the AG's department and the Supreme Court judged on with regards to the Online Safety Act that was passed in Parliament in a very unconstitutional manner as well, so even that's contested. But the judgment itself was extraordinarily bad. And one of the, to put it simply, I think it's very clear when you read the judgment that the bench doesn't know, isn't aware of, and hasn't been told around what online harms constitute. So they're going with a very dated, outdated understanding and notion of regulation, harms, media, and the information landscape. And there doesn't seem to be any awareness at the Supreme Court and the legal fraternity writ large around some of the issues that we are talking about on this call, which is a Gordian knot. I mean, they don't have jurisprudence that's particularly clear. But even on that score, Sri Lanka's judiciary and the legal fraternity are not up to date. And that's very clear in the judgment. So we have a lot to catch up in that regard, and that affords autocratic fiat. So the net result of that is that our government and our executive presidents have a proclivity and a propensity and a culture of impunity, given that even PIL pushback is so weak, to do as they see fit, in line with what others have spoken about in other countries. Arbitrary regulation, arbitrary laws, extra-constitutional or contra-constitutional orders given to telcos, metadata at scale. And I'll end by saying that one of the things that we take as a frontier issue is the advent of generative AI and what that will mean for state authorities in the harvesting at scale of what they do, and then the subsequent targeting on an individual or institutional or issue-specific way. In ways that there is no legal jurisprudence or regulatory framework currently contemplated in the country. So that's just not a frontier issue. That's actually a front door issue, given what we have seen in the country. But that's perhaps a different discussion. But in the simplest way I can say is that with respect to the answer that was given from India, we are at a far more embryonic stage. And I would argue, as a consequence, we are more fragile and open to autocratic fiat and abuse as a consequence of the fragility and the outbounded nature of our courts.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Sanjana. I know we are running out of time, but I would just love to quickly get Fariyan's take on this as well, especially because we have been talking about national security, that being a justification for erosion of end-to-end encryption. Brinda also mentioned that it is tricky for courts to sort of balance these interests. Dr. Sanjana also mentioned that especially in times of fragility, that these issues become even more heightened. And given that you had mentioned that Pakistan, given an election year, the judicial appointments are sort of happening in the way, how is Pakistan sort of dealing with this debate between national security and any other possible challenges surrounding concerns of privacy, freedom of speech and expression?
Well, the problem is, as Dr. Sanjana pointed out, unqualified claims of national security. And we expect that the courts assert themselves a little more and ask the executive to qualify what exactly is threatening national security in the context of the X ban. And they've blocked it. The ministers are using X via VPNs, which they are also blocking and registering. Just say the hypocrisy of it all, right? And I mean, at least question why and for what purpose and what is it serving? So there's that aspect. And again, in terms of authorizing an intelligence agency post facto to then conduct mass surveillance, that also, what is the requirement? And on the flip side, because a lot of habeas corpus petitions for abductions of citizens are filed before our high courts. In those cases, the CDR is never provided. Somehow the Safe City cameras never work. They can never trace the people who are actually abducted. None of the existing system ever gets used to actually trace the culprits. But on the flip side, and what in addition to what is happening, is we also have courts who have an antagonistic view of social media. And so we had the present Chief Justice saying that all of these vloggers who make dollars and are on payrolls, etc., and because there's been critique of obviously the Supreme Court and the judges and others as well. And on the other hand, I mean, we've gone through this judicial crisis where High Court judges actually wrote a letter and came out and said that, you know, the establishment is controlling. There were cameras found in judges' bedrooms. There's a lot that happened. And the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice basically looked the other way. And so within the course, you also had some leaning in one direction and some the other. But contempt proceedings, because then you had these proxy wars where those judges were slandered because they were taking on the institution. But then they went the contempt route as well, saying, oh, now there has to be data scraping. Who's trending these hashtags? And where is this data, personal data of judges being leaked and campaigns being run against them, and including the mainstream media? So there's a lot of friction within the judiciary as well. And now with, Dr. Sanjana mentioned the jackboot, and that's all. We've had a checkered judicial history. But at the same time, here, the executive, there's more entrenchment happening. In terms, you want a judiciary that is independent, that challenges the executive, and citizens go to court against the executive. You want the courts to be able to deliver. However, where that happens, the judges are sidelined, or, you know, if, for example, the Islamabad High Court order, which was then stayed by the Supreme Court, and now they want to just reshuffle the judges and also the whole within the judiciary. So at the moment, we don't know. Also, the whole practice of devices just being taken. People are abducted, arrested, the devices are taken. So there's no protection. Even a data protection bill, which is sort of in the works, provides more access to government, facilitates more government access to data rather than protecting. And so for me, always, the intent is in question. The narratives are the same. We have to protect citizens and protect women and children especially, right? Those protectionist, paternalistic narratives. But none of that actually happens. And under the garb of all of that and national security, the encroachment of the state is entrenched. And that's essentially what we've seen through law, rulemaking within the judiciary, attitudinal issues. And at this point, honestly, even the gains somewhat that we have made, they stand... they may be reversed given how now the courts are going to be restructured, whether the jurisprudence will still apply. Are we going to start with a fresh, clean slate? And then who's going to head those constitutional benches, which obviously we seem to think are going to be handpicked appointees who will block any kind of rights-based advocacy and litigation. And there are various cases pending, but they're not getting anywhere.
Wonderful. That's really interesting. Wish we could go on for longer. But if we could now move on to the Q&A. Okay, I believe we are over time. We will have to close the panel there. I'm so sorry, Santosh and Shanti. I did specifically want to ask you a couple of questions that I had noted down, but we are running out of time. So I think we will have to close the session here. I will take an opportunity to thank all of our wonderful, wonderful panelists. This was a great, very enriching, insightful discussion that we've had. And it's been a pleasure to be on this discussion with you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.